From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. That didn't take long. Such a good start. I'm Evan Dawson. I'm going to keep reading
this. Keeping it.
Yes, we're keeping it. We're keeping it. I'm Evan Dawson.
I'm Megan Mack. Welcome to our phenomenally produced podcast. I am not in charge of the board.
You're not. That is all me. That is for sure. We had a fast pace.
Continually improving. Remember, this is a pledge week, listeners.
It is. Yes, it is. We had a fast-paced pledge week, a spring membership campaign. Woo! Let's just pretend
we're
that
really
this is normal.
We're really keeping this?
Yes, we're keeping it. We are keeping it. We are one-take Jakes here. Our guests were all over the spectrum of topics. We had a priest who has worked with several popes. We had the story of the unsolved Rochester Brinks heist. So covered a lot of ground this week.
Let's start with the priest that Evan was talking about. Father Thomas Rozica is a Rochester native. He grew up here, he went to Aquinas, and then to St. John Fisher College. And when he got into the priesthood, he traveled the world. He lived in the Middle East for 5 years, and eventually Father Rozica ended up in Toronto. In 2002, the Vatican asked him to lead World Youth Day with Pope John Paul II.
And then Father Rozica launched a Catholic news service in Canada. It's called Salt and Light. And when Pope Benedict resigned, Father Rozica assisted the Vatican with media relations during the transition to Pope Francis. And he's traveled with Pope Francis, helping with interviews and English translations.
Father Rozica was back in Rochester this week to lead a retreat at St. Joe's in Penfield. We talked about a number of subjects. In this clip, you'll hear Evan ask Father Rozica about Pope Benedict, because Father Rozica was insisting that we get it wrong, that Benedict and Francis have more in common than we realize.
What you're telling us is some of the narrative about Benedict is unfair or misunderstands the man, that he wasn't necessarily cold or, you know, not interested in inclusion, prickly, more closed off, a smaller, more devoted church was more interested in, as opposed to bringing in more voices. You're saying we misunderstand the man if that's the only narrative we have. My response to you, because what you tell us, he was a brilliant theologian. He was more technical. He was a writer. He was a scholar in ways that Francis is not, but he had different gifts. So my response to that would be, well, he should have stayed a cardinal then, because as a pope, you have a responsibility that Francis is carrying out in ways that that pope did not, and that his better role was as a cardinal and not as a pope.
I think one of the first qualities of a pope, someone elected to that, should be that they never sought the job. John Paul II never sought the job. Benedict never wanted it.
Ratzinger wanted that job. Come on.
Oh, no.
No?
No, I can guarantee you.
See, that's another narrative that's out there, that he was very good at maneuvering for the job.
Many narratives need to be shot. I can guarantee you.
Okay.
This was a man at 78 years old who was looking forward to his retirement. He wanted to go back to Germany, play piano with his brother, and write books. And then he was thrust into this job. And I look back now over history, having been there through the whole transition of John Paul II to Benedict, and then from Benedict to Francis, and watching how those things happened. Who could have been the candidate? Who would have been the candidate? The closest advisor to John Paul II. The church was in a very precarious state at that moment. After a 27-year run, if you will, of a pontificate, John Paul II. Remember the funeral of John Paul II, the greatest television moment in history. The world mourned over all of that. This is a great world figure. And Benedict comes along, someone to keep. He knew he wasn't going to be there a long time. But look at the significant things that Benedict did. One of the first things, within weeks, is to open up the whole abuse question, to say we cannot put this under the carpet, sweep it under the carpet. This must be addressed. Number two, the reforms that Francis is being credited for right now began little by little, the financial reform, the other reform. My regret for Pope Benedict is this. He was very poorly served by the people who were with him. He trusted people that he had known for a long time, and sometimes that's not necessarily the best thing. And he deserved much better. The greatest thing that Benedict did was the humility of stepping down. I mean, this greatest figure, only Benedict could have pulled something off like that. The humility that he showed, that I am not capable of leading this forward. Someone else must come. And now to see Benedict and to witness his role, it's the sweet surrender of humility and strength. And he's there, and there's a great relationship between him and between Francis. Contrary to what the media people are saying, that they're at odds with each other. Benedict, he's there in the Vatican Gardens, living in the convent. He's a man of prayer, and his works continue to speak.
Let's turn to the still unsolved Rochester Brinks heist of 1993. That's when armed robbers broke into the Brinks Depot, tied up the guards, and made off with more than $7 million in cash. Democrat and Chronicle reporter Gary Craig tells the story in his new book called 7 Million.
The trail leads all the way to the dank prisons of Northern Ireland. There are ties to the IRA and a New York City priest. And in this clip, we recount with Gary the gripping moments that unfolded on that cold night in January of 1993. What they were doing was any run-of-the-mill night. It was them, along with a retired cop, Mr. O'Connor.
Tom O'Connor.
And they were just doing what they always do, which is counting the money, recounting it, getting it set. Popovich had devised a nice little system for them, so they were trying to get out of there for the night. They were trying to get back to their families, and take us through what happened on that night.
Yeah, I mean, they basically, those were the three, Dick Popovich, Milt Deal, Tom O'Connor, and you know, they were counting the money to be delivered to the banks the next day, and basically... Well, Tom O'Connor had gone out to bring in some, you know, basically some more canvas bags for loading the money. And Milt Deal and Dick Popovich are basically confronted by these armed gunmen.
Who, you know, masked one gunmen. Of the guards thought this was a joke at first, right?
Yeah, I mean, that was, yeah, Milton Deal, when you read the transcripts, basically there's, you know, the court transcripts mentions that at first he thought this was some bizarre sort of, which would be a really weird, because it could lead to trouble, obviously, but some sort of bizarre test that Brinks was doing, but obviously he realized very quickly it wasn't.
No, and so both of those guys, Dick and Milt, were smart enough not to resist. They wanted to preserve their lives, and Gary kind of takes us through those moments where they get kind of tied up. They're on the ground wondering if they're about to be killed, and they're trying to listen to the sounds around them, which was a smart thing to do as well there, because all of a sudden the mundanities become much more profound that you're listening to, the sounds that you would hear every day, the sounds of tires and those kinds of things. The whole robbery didn't take too long, though, right, Gary?
If they're probably out of there in 20-some minutes, I would think, yeah.
Okay, and the question, you know, the reader is going to have, and the question that I'm sure Milton Dick had was, well, where's Tom O'Connor? What happened?
Yeah, well, that's so...
The third guard.
Exactly. So basically, as they're tied up and ultimately put sort of side by side. They weren't in the same room when they were first, you know, basically overtaken. And you know, Dick hears Milt Deal say something, so he realizes that you know, Milton is there. And then, you know, one of the robbers says, you know, we've got your buddy or something like that. I don't remember the exact words. And so they then realize that...
Call the police and we'll kill him.
Yeah, exactly. And Tom O'Connor, they realize they've got Tom O'Connor. And so when, you know, Popovich is able to sort of maneuver himself free, and they call 911, and, you know, cops arrive, and Tom is gone. I use first names. I've been writing this so long.
it's like, you know, and you do know some of them, yeah.
And you know, he ultimately ends up, you know, dropped off. He was, you know, by his account, taken hostage and dropped off at a restaurant that he'd frequented before, near there, close enough that he knew, you know, where to go. And so ultimately, you know, they all end up, thankfully, alive and well.
But... $7.4 million is gone. There are instantly questions about how in the world robbers could get in. And it didn't really help the Brinks Depot's case that the door itself, you said you could just put a shoulder on the door and push hard and that thing would open. That's not great security for a place that's hiding, holding tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah, there was testimony to that. And also, I mean, even if they had secured that well, there was testimony that, you know, the guards themselves, some of them had gotten a little bit lax and would allow folks to sort of come in. I think there was a story, you know, there is a story in the book mentioned just in passing about a girlfriend who comes in, you know, with a check or something, and a guy who delivers a pizza. And
oh, they turn around and they're like, oh, the pizza guy's in the vault.
Exactly.
Like, how did he get in here?
So, you know, so it had gotten a little lax the way they were handling it. And there were, you know, Dick Popovich talks about he had raised issues about some of the security measures with Brinks and was unhappy with the response he was getting. And that became, you know, Tom O'Connor ultimately is accused of being the inside guy with the robbery and is acquitted at trial. But his major defense at trial was, you know, this claim that this place was ripe for a robbery, and you know, which his lawyer, Felix Lapine, I think, has termed it a cheese box or something. But
yes. I like that, cheese box. Yes. So anybody could have robbed it. You know, it doesn't have to be the IRA, right? It doesn't have to be. Tom doesn't have. You don't need an inside job to rob this depot. But Gary also has a great quote in there. I was asking before the hour. I said, "How did you get this quote?" One of the cops that very night when they were investigating, apparently said to, I guess maybe it said in passing to another cop, if Tom O'Connor isn't dead, he did it. How did you get that quote?
Yeah, that was, there's a reason there's not a name attached to that one. You know, that was...
You want to break any news here?
Exactly. That, you know, that was somebody who knew I was working on the book and was in this room with cops, you know, when this happened. And you know, basically, you know, this was not Tom O'Connor's first brush with the law.
Next, we turn to a World War II veteran for a little wisdom. Pete Dupre is known as Harmonica Pete around here. He was a medic in World War II, and he's played his harmonica at remembrance ceremonies around the world. He shared some wonderful stories with us about his life, his music, and his service.
But his concern about war is what we're focusing on in this clip. Pete calls himself an optimist, and he doesn't share the cynicism about younger generations that some of his peers have. But when it comes to war, Pete worries that we'll never learn from our past.
Scares the heck out of me. I don't like the way things are going at all. Not that I can control it, but I see repeating
history
things.
Repeating?
Yeah. Unlearned history.
What's an example of that, Pete?
They do something. They don't do something. I guess that's a crazy way to answer your question, but there's always some they. And you got to go get they because they're not doing it the way it's supposed to be done. And so what do you do? Well, then you go shoot them.
And so you're talking about the way we talk about other people who are they.
Other people are they.
The other.
Yeah.
Instead of looking for common humanity.
Yeah. And we're always ready to go after they, whoever they are, without trying to say, let's really get rid of the politics into this. I'd love to see the leaders of the world sit in a room like this and talk, you know, and they say, well, that could never possibly happen, but maybe it could. It's just, here I am at 94, and when we talk about things, we talk about what war are we talking about? And because in this period of time, I've lived through a number of wars, and they're just, I just see them repeating themselves. Then why? Because they don't do it our way, or they did something, and I didn't like it, so I got to change it.
I think what Pete's telling us is the opposition in wars change, but there's always a they.
Mm-hmm. Always, yeah.
And we have to create a world where we stop othering.
But God said the same thing. Nero said the same thing. Aristotle said the same thing, you know. And so we aren't learning too well or haven't learned too well, but it scares me.
We're closing on a lighter note. Writing for Slate, Ron Rosenbaum argued that Billy Joel is the worst pop artist ever. He had his reasons, but more importantly, Rosenbaum wrote that when it comes to evaluating art of any kind, we have to be willing to call out the bad in order to fully appreciate what is good.
In other words, Rosenbaum does not believe in the concept of there is no good and bad, there's only what you like and don't like. He says there is bad art, and Billy Joel is an example of it. Our guests discussed whether they agree that calling out bad art is necessary to identify good art. You're going to hear John Kovach, the director of the Institute for Popular Music at the University of Rochester, and Leah Stacey, a Nazareth College professor and a freelance theater critic for City Newspaper.
Everybody's got an opinion. They have a right to it. You know, you go to a ball game, you buy a ticket, you got a right to call the pitcher a bum. You know, I mean, and you buy a CD or you don't buy it and have it on your computer some other kind of way. You know, as a fan, you've got a right to like things and to dislike them. But if you're going to, I mean, the funny thing about Rosenbaum's piece, and again, this is from a few years ago, this piece of his, but I don't expect, given the severity of his judgment, he's changed his mind.
No, we've been in touch with him this week. He's not changed.
Really, really. So he still doesn't like Billy Joel.
No, but yeah. He says he's gotten plenty of blowback from the Billy Joel fans out there.
I think he's got a perfect right to that opinion, but I'm not quite sure he establishes much of a set of criterion for establishing good and bad. He mostly just complains about the lyrics.
Yeah, that's the fascinating thing here, and we're going to touch on that in just a second because, look, it's Friday. Let's get in the weeds a little on Billy Joel music. Let's have a little fun, and then we'll talk about the broader question of art. But John's right here. There is an inconsistency, and we invited Ron to come on the program, and he declined. He said the piece speaks for itself. If it does, what the piece is saying is that maybe there's two separate things. Go ahead and like what you like. Mm-hmm. Drink the wine you want to drink. look at the art you want to look at, own it, buy it, listen to the music you want to listen to. But then if we were going to get critical, understand that we are going to need quality baselines here. Yeah. And he's setting Billy Joel as the bottom. The problem, though, you're right, is part of that quality baseline is much more based on what he views as, you know, lyrics that are problematic, yeah, as opposed
that's
composition,
you know,
of songs.
He's a journalist. He's a words guy. Those are the kinds of things he goes for. You know, I posted that on my Facebook page that I was going to be with you today talking about this. Already a couple of my musician friends, you know, these are like fantastic musicians,
yeah,
you know, who are basically saying, I don't understand this guy's take on Billy Joel at all. I think his music is wonderful. And so, you know, different people are going to look for different things in the music. That's fine. I think the one way in which, I mean, because I don't want to criticize Ron for sounding off on this, because I think his job as a journalist is different than my job as a scholar or, you know, as a historian. His job is really to express his opinion in a kind of a sharp way that's going to prompt discussion. And he's done so.
He sure has.
Because here we sit. So from that point of view, that's really his role. I mean, I'm not so sure it's right to say it's his role to decide what constitutes good and bad art, good and bad pop, good and bad songwriting. He's got his opinion. That's fantastic. But I think what I take away from it is he thinks there should be a sense that things are good and bad and that everything shouldn't just be okay, hey, whatever. And to a certain extent, most of us scholars, most of us music historians, music theorists, intellectuals, you know, we make our money trying to tell people what we think the good stuff is and directing them toward it and basically tell them that they don't really need to worry so much about the stuff that's not as good. Maybe our opinions are a little bit more broadly cast, but still, ultimately, that's the job. Nobody wants to take a class for a music professor who says, well, basically, it's all about the same and all good. Just listen to what you like.
Yeah, exactly. All right, Leah Stacey, mm-hmm. Two questions. I'll start with this. Is Billy Joel that bad?
All right, so I think that I would be classified by some people as one of those hipster types who would, you would expect to criticize him and maybe not like him, but I got to tell you, my dad plays the guitar and the piano, and I grew up listening to him play Billy Joel. And so for me, it has a very nostalgic connection.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've never hated Billy Joel. Actually, when I hear it, it brings me back to some really happy times. So I know that's probably not the answer maybe you were looking
for.
No,
but for you, he's fine, right?
Yeah, for me, I've never been bothered by him.
I mean, Nickelback exists, and we're still doing
now,
Billy Joel is the worst.
Me.
We know what the worst is. We've got it. I don't know why we're doing this. Anyway, broader question then, which we're going to spend more time on later. What do you make of the premise, though, that Ron Rosenbaum touches on, which is, in art, you know, we got to know what's bad. We have to say what's bad. Not everything is good. If everything's good, then nothing is good. What do you think?
I do agree with that, actually. And maybe I'm on the harsher side of this argument, but, you know, as a critic and somebody who went through training to be a critic, and mine is more specifically in theater, not in music, but music is certainly part of theater. And I think that, yes, we do have to set standards. I think critics are given the responsibility to set those standards a lot of the time. And it's an interesting conversation, especially in a city of this size, when you are the critic of people you see in Wegmans.
Yes. Is it? I was going to ask you if it's hard to be critical. It's hard to write sharp lines at times.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is hard. But again, I take that responsibility very seriously. And I think that on the theater side of things, like, we have this very vibrant scene. And if we are not sort of doing our duty on the criticism side of things and, you know, calling out those artistic things that we really think they could, it's not that we don't think they're capable. We think that they need to step it up because we know they are capable.
Yeah. So in other words, if every play you reviewed was good, then why would I think that anything is good?
Nobody would read my reviews.
I would just argue that Ron Rosenbaum is wrong as long as Nickelback is in the world, don't you think,
oh,
Megan Mack?
Oh, Nickelback reference.
Well, I mean, like, I thought they, aren't they the standard
yes,
of
everyone
bad?
Says Nickelback is, yes. Yeah, that's fair.
But do you disagree?
No, I don't like Nickelback. But I like Duran Duran, so I don't know if you should be coming to me for music advice.
Duran Duran had some really, really, really good stuff. I love Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
That was the Beatles. The Beatles. Good try.
Yeah. Okay, come undone. Best Duran Duran song. Yes or no?
No.
Okay, we don't agree on anything. With that, let's say goodbye. You can listen to Connections every weekday afternoon, noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
We're also on the WXXI mobile app. And don't worry, next week's podcast will be better produced than this one. Have a good weekend, everyone. Talk to you Monday.